Good evening.
You might have wondered why we showed you this conversation portrait. We have an artist in residence named Flash Rosenberg, who often draws conversations. In this particular case, the reason I chose this particular conversation portrait is because of Antonio Lobo Antunes, of course, but because Robert Weil, his editor, is in the audience tonight. Robert Weil is one of the greatest editors in America today. He has been at Norton for decades, and now, very recently, he became the publisher and has now his own imprint, Leverite Publishing Corporation, which is part of Norton. Bob Weil has brought to the New York Public Library so many wonderful writers, be it Lobo Antunes, who you saw before, Jan Morris, or indeed the great E.O. Wilson. So thank you, Bob, for helping bring these great minds and stylists to be part of the New York Public Library Live series. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and my goal here at the library is simply to make, as you know me to say so many times, to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and when possible, to make it levitate. Briefly, I'd like to tell you about a few of our upcoming events. We have on April 25th, Slavoj Žižek, who will talk of the year 2011. His talk is entitled 2011, the Year of Dreaming Dangerously. On May 1st, I will be speaking to this year's National Book Award winner, Jesmyn Ward. And on May 15th, live from the New York Public Library, we will be welcoming the great pianist Van Cliburn. So join the New York Public Library, become a friend, and join our mailing list so you may find out about these events. After the conversation tonight, E.O. Wilson will be signing The Social Conquest of Earth. As always, it gives me great pleasure to thank our independent bookseller, 192 Books, for being our excellent bookseller. In conversation tonight with E.O. Wilson, it is a great pleasure to welcome to this stage Natalie D'Souza. Natalie D'Souza is an editor at Nature Methods since 2006. Before working at Nature Methods, she studied, now I'm sorry not to understand what is written here, the sulfate in round worm at Columbia University, and now I'm understanding even less, a protein movement within cells at Rockefeller University. She has written for Nature publications and for Cabinet. As you know, over the past few years, I have asked my guests to offer me seven words which would or would not define them, a haiku of sorts, or as I say, if we want to be very modern, a tweet. Now, Natalie's seven words are Bombay, books, sciences, science, interstices, New York, and I love her parentheses here, New York counts as one word, I hope, wandering and questions, which she will be asking shortly. It is an honor to welcome E.O. Wilson back to the New York Public Library and to this program. You all know that E.O. Wilson is regarded as one of the world's preeminent biologists and naturalists. He's a creator, he's an author of some 27 books, including Naturalist, The Creation, and of course, The Ants. He's a professor emeritus at Harvard University. You may not know that E.O. Wilson had the nickname in grammar school of Bugs. His two Pulitzer Prizes are for general nonfiction. When a few years ago I had the occasion to meet the Spanish writer Antonio Lobo Antunes, he told me that a student of his at Bard College had asked him how he should learn to write. What would be good for him to read? And he said, in order for you to learn how to describe as a novelist, read The Ants. Here are E.O. Wilson's seven words. the ants came, spoke, taught, and judged. Lastly, the Icelandic pop star Björk last year released an album entitled Biophilia, inspired by E.O. Wilson's 1984 book of the same name. Ladies and gentlemen, please warmly welcome to this stage, live from the New York Public Library, Natalie D'Souza and Edward O. Wilson.
The nickname Bugs last?
Sorry?
How long did the nickname Bugs last?
Well, unfortunately, just a couple of years, and then I spent time, a lot of time on snakes, and I came to be known as Snake Wilson. In
So, on the way here, I was at the Morgan Library, which is just around the corner, and I went to see an exhibition which is called In the Company of Animals. Mm-hmm. Which, have you seen it?
I have not.
Well, it's a collection of the Morgans' objects, paintings, and so on animals. And I was struck by a line that was quoted by the curators to introduce the exhibition, which is a line from Claude Lévi-Strauss, which says, animals are good to think with. And it struck me that that's actually a very nice way of describing what a lot of biologists do. And in particular, it's a good way of describing what you have done in this new book, The Social mm-hmm. Conquest of Earth. So you use animals, social insects, to think with about humans. So I'd like to start, therefore, with these animals. I'd like to ask you about the eusocial insects. Yes. And what is a eusocial insect, and why are they good to think with?
I want to back up a bit and just talk about the strategy of doing modern biology, because I know you've taken part in this in your own work at Rockefeller, mm-hmm. and the mention was made of roundworms mm-hmm. as a source of great knowledge. Sometimes the humble animals and plants that we use to get biological knowledge, it works its way all up the way to human beings and the important parts of human biology, and in this case, social behavior, are indeed very humble. Mm-hmm. But when we get a feel for the organism, we do, then we can use them as what we call model species. Mm-hmm. Meaning that, and this is the first rule of successful biological research. For those out there among you, do I have students looking here too? Who are thinking of a scientific career, the first rule of doing scientific research in biology, in my mind, is that for every problem in biology, there exists an animal or plant, a species, for which it is ideally suited. And the inverse of that as well. Let me just put it this way. So what you have done, and some of your distinguished colleagues, is upon approaching the organization of the nervous system.
Yes, the C. elegans, the roundworm, yes.
Yeah, you mm-hmm. couldn't do an awful lot with, there'd be relatively few human volunteers that would allow you to open them up. So what you have done is follow this first rule of taking a very simple organism.
With 300 neurons.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You can do something with 300 neurons, mm-hmm. right down to the molecular level. Mm-hmm. So this has been an enormous enormously successful overall program. For molecular genetics, the great advances in molecular genetics, what did we do? We went, the biologist, went to the gut bacterium, E. coli.
Mm-hmm.
And for learning about learning, you know, the molecular biology of memory, one of our distinguished colleagues went to a sea slug.
Yeah, he was on this stage, Eric Kandel, last week, as
Good.
A matter of fact.
A great man. Well, so this is the way we do things. Now, analytic biologists, the kind that want to solve a great problem in biology, you know, how do you put a nervous system together? What is the genetic basis of heredity and so on? What is the molecular basis? Follow that first rule. They have a problem and they search until they get the right animal or plant for it. Now, the inverse of this, these are, incidentally, I modestly call them Wilson's two rules.
Okay.
The second one is the inverse of that is, and it is for every animal and plant and group of animals and plants and microorganisms, there exists a problem somewhere for which the organism is ideally suited.
I have to say, I like the idea that if you're going to have two rules about something as complex as science, they might as well be the inverse of each other.
So, at any rate, you can come into biology. I'm now talking to younger scientists. I'm not sure if there are any in the room, really. But at least you're the parents or grandparents of some. When I say that a good way to get into biology, serious biology, and this is really working off what you first brought up, is to get an organism you love. You have a feel for it. It could be birds. It could be butterflies. And for heaven's sakes, it could be roundworms. And you get a feel for it, and you become fascinated enough to learn enough to know that you are now finding out new things about it. And then you can follow that second rule, and you can say, I love this group. I want to spend the rest of my life working on snakes, on mud skippers, on whatever it is. I'm going to do it. I'm determined to spend all my life working with this group.
So you followed the second rule.
Yeah.
You fell in love with insects first.
Well, I did when I was about 9 years old.
Yeah.
So now the next question you ask is, how can I build a career out of it? And now, in a roundabout way, that's brought me to answering your question. Why ants? Well, ants are our model species. Model species, mm-hmm. You know, like your nematodes.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on them a good part of my life, and I know a fair amount about them, and I have often said, what kind of important biology can be done with ants? And now, toward the end of my career, because so much has been accumulated in the primary research literature on every aspect of human evolution and the human condition, all the way from the molecular genetics of human genetic variation, all the way to archaeology and even history, so much has been put together that the time has come, I thought, to take a scientific look at the three great questions, well, the first two of the three great questions of religion and philosophy, which we abandoned a long time ago and stopped talking about a long time ago, and they are, where do we come from, what are we, and where are we going? And I felt that since religion can't answer that question, because, you know, every religion has a different creation story, and they all conflict, it would appear that none of them is correct. And besides, they were devised, most of them, in the Neolithic or late Iron Age, and therefore based upon not a great deal of knowledge. Philosophy can't do the job because, well, philosophy has been trying for millennia, and they really come up zero. I'm only exaggerating a little, I think, when I say that philosophy, to a large extent, consists of failed models of the brain. We spend a lot of time in professional philosophy courses trying to get into students' heads just what did Kant really think. And so on. Well, but we know now how a lot of the brain works, and we're zeroing in on consciousness. Well, why would I bring ants into the picture? And I'll tell you why. Virtually every attempt to answer those three questions has been totally human-oriented. Starts in the human sciences and the humanities and knocks around in there and tries to derive the answer from that quite myopic point of view. But if we took you social insects, and I will, or creatures, I'll define it in a moment, and looked over the entire landscape of the origin of those advanced stages, those insects and other organisms that have reached that advanced level, then we would have a background, possibly, to derive general principles about where advanced social organization originated, how it originated, under what conditions, and what it really means.
So you sociality describes this advanced social organization. That's what you're saying.
I was going to define you social for you. And that is that advanced stage of social organization, mm-hmm. in which there is multiple generations, mm-hmm. there is the rearing of the young cooperatively, mm-hmm. there is a division of labor to some extent of among the members of the colony, some of whom surrender a little bit of their reproductive abilities or longevity or both in the service of the colony. That means to the others. And that is what we find in the social insects, ants, termites, bees, wasps. We also find it in a variety of other creatures. Now they've been studied, thrips, aphids. There's a eusocial shrimp species living in sponges and so on. We've got a lot of knowledge now about this. And what is absolutely remarkable, putting humans aside for a moment, is that there are about 22 dozen separate evolutionary lines in the history of life, only two dozen we know of, that ever reached that level. And how did they reach it? And here's the astonishing thing. Everyone, without exception, that we can divine, you know, as to how it happened, did it by when a solitary creature or two solitary creatures, a mated pair, evolved so that they were now produced a nest, like a mud dauber nest, as an example.
Yes.
That is a fairly elaborate, expensive to make, needs to be defended, and from which the adult solitary wasp or bee or whatever it is goes forth, gathers food, brings it back to the nest, feeds the young until they grow up. And that is the gateway, the narrow gateway to eusocial behavior.
The nest is, you mean?
Everyone.
The
ants are the one group we can't track because the earliest ants we know are about 110 million years old. We only have scattered fossils. There are no solitary ones or early social ones, which you have in bees and wasps. Those are the ones we go to get the picture more complete. Now, that's really interesting. There are large numbers of species in the world that have reached the gateway, the threshold, but haven't crossed over. But nonetheless, only those who have done so cross over. And we need to ask why it has been so rare. It is because all these steps have to be gone through in this maze of evolution, of random changes going one direction in evolution or another, lead you into blind alleys of the maze where you stay maybe for 10 million years, or it may take a turn that leads you to open opportunities, you evolve a little further.
Your sociality is complex to evolve, is that what you're saying?
That's how complexity
evolves.
Your
sociality is difficult to evolve. It's not an easy thing to evolve it.
That's precisely right. Yeah. There are large numbers who are close to the threshold but who haven't gone over. Now that brings us to humans. With that,
well, can I ask you a question though first?
Okay, I'm talking too much.
I will interrupt you. Don't worry.
What? I want to hear from you.
I'm always a little puzzled when you know I hear about social insects or eusociality being rare. I mean, how does one know? I it must be complicated to interpret the fossil record, which I know nothing about, when it comes to jawbones and so on. I mean, but to interpret, 100 million year old fossils in terms of social behavior, fraught with problems.
Yeah, we can deduce a lot of social behavior from fossils.
Mm-hmm.
I've processed thousands of ant fossils in amber going all the way back for 100 million years. And you can deduce a lot by looking at the anatomy of it, what kind of adaptations it may have had, and whether it had caste.
So when one says, you know, there have been few instances of evolution of social insects, one is fairly confident that that's true, you would say.
Of what am I?
Of social insects.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. We have a very good idea of this, and this is a remarkable phenomenon because it explains what I saw was the one of the two most basic questions we had to answer. These are the problems.
Well, let's go back to the adaptations that you said are needed to evolve eusociality.
I'm coming to that, but I wanted to pose first the two key questions.
Okay.
So these are the questions that nobody ever, to my knowledge, in biology ever ask or attempt to answer. The first one is, why is eusocial behavior so rare, and why did it take so long to evolve? Mm-hmm. Even ants, bees, wasps we went through a Paleozoic period of insect evolution, which over 100 million years produced an enormous array of insects in the old coal forest.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't see any evidence of any social insect. Then we go over to the Mesozoic, go through the Triassic, pardon me, and we have to finally get to the early Jurassic, say 150, 200 million years ago, that the first social insects appear. And humans, of course, didn't appear until practically yesterday.
Mm.
So that's the first question we have to answer. That's a very important problem. The second one is, pardon me, what was the force that moved species into the eusocial condition? I think we have the answers to those now, and we won't go into that in detail unless you press me.
To hear a little bit. What are your ideas about the evolution of eusociality in insects? I mean, that's the core. That's the scientific core of your book.
That is right.
You've also, published on that separately, but it's the core of your book.
Yeah, okay. Let's do it for an insect first.
Let's do it for an insect.
And then we'll do it for humans.
Okay, let's start with the insect.
I'm going to walk you through human evolution, and us through. Human evolution to take you to the critical moment, period 3 million years ago, when the human species walked through to eusociality. Okay. In insects, it starts. Solitary insects, everybody's familiar with those. That's the dominant form of life. Then there are various routes to go into social behavior of one form or another, but the most familiar is the female builds a nest, puts an egg in that's going to develop into a larva, and then dumps a caterpillar that's paralyzed or something like this. The next stage is she builds a nest, and then she stays around and starts feeding this little growing larva until it gets larger. And the next one is she builds a more elaborate nest and raises larvae all the way through and stays with them until the final stage they disperse. And then those species that are at that last stage that have made it through that far have only to get one mutation that silences dispersal. You have a eusocial colony.
Mm-hmm.
So given that there are a lot of those that build nests like mud daubers, like birds and so on. So mm-hmm. what is, and you can move them to eusociality with one mutation, theoretically. Why don't they do it? Why has this happened more often? Answer, because these are species that have evolved in solitary life for tens to hundreds of millions of years of ancestry. One little mutation now dumps them into a domain in which they must be eusocial or die, but they're so thoroughly adapted to solitary life that they're not really ready to function as a group.
So they need to be pre-adapted somehow.
They have to be pre-adapted to get there. Mm. And then they have to be in a situation which we don't understand yet, because this is the part that hasn't been we haven't even begun to study this part. There has to be a powerful force called group selection that overcomes individual selection that has dominated the evolution up to that point. And when that group selection is there for some environmental circumstance we don't know yet, for some other internal mechanism we haven't investigated yet, because we've only now got this idea to work on.
So that's the core idea.
Then we will understand why in insects and other creatures, animals, it's happened only 24 times roughly. And notice, this is what really magnifies the importance of it and the puzzle of it. These are the tiny, this in this tiny group, and then in humans, are creatures that dominated the environment. That's what I meant, social conquest of the world. Ants, bees, and wasps, the social ones, make up something like two-thirds of the entire insect biomass. They're only maybe at most in a particular, worldwide, in 20,000 species.
So when it happens, it's a very successful strategy.
A very select group, having reached eusociality, dominated the world.
Yeah.
That's why ants are everywhere.
Yeah.
And termites are bringing down houses in New Orleans and so on.
Yeah.
Well, okay, shall we go to...
So group selection is the idea that evolution is acting at the group level, not on the individual member of the group. Natural selection is acting at the group level to make a more successful group. And so that it would promote these sort of altruism-like traits that make one ant, the worker ant, give up the need to reproduce or give up reproductive rights for the queen.
The key is that when you're in a group,
you
subordinate yourself to some degree in it to be eusocial.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether you're related genetically.
Yeah.
That was the old idea.
Well, that's very controversial, isn't it?
What?
That's very controversial.
Yes, we dumped that idea in November 2010.
Yes.
Two mathematicians and myself.
Yes.
And I'll just mention that, yes, that's controversial. But actually, there's a long history to it. And I don't want to go into it completely, except to say that for four decades, this theory, the ruling theory was very roughly, that eusociology took off. And most forms of altruism came into being, and eusociality could occur when you had a group of close kin living with one another. Then they would help one another, and if one sacrificed itself for a relative, and that relative was very close, a brother, sister, especially, or at most a first cousin, then that individual would not lose Darwinian fitness, even though, say, it had few offspring or died young, because if it increased the genetic fitness, that is, the longevity and particularly the number of offspring placed in the next generation of that close relative, then that more than compensated so that the genes they have in common due to the same parents, common descent, those would be favored by that act of altruism. That was the brilliant idea that prevailed in research and talk about eusocial and other advanced social behavior. And it's wrong.
Well, it was an idea. It was an idea that you
what?
It was an idea that you liked for a long time.
Is what?
It was an idea that you liked for
a long
time.
Oh, I was one of those who most actively promoted it.
Yeah.
In fact, if you don't mind, if you have a copy of my book, Sociobiology, or the one on ants, I won't mind if you raise that particular chapter out.
I don't have it here.
Okay, well.
But what?
I mean,
what
how can we be scientists unless we change our mind?
I agree with that. What made you change your mind in this case? What made you change your mind?
Well, as the years passed, I began to notice that as popular and seductive as that idea is, that not that much was being done with it. It got good results in two areas of social behavior, both of them rather esoteric. One of them was that the closer wasps are to one another, you know, genetically, the closer kin they are, the less conflict they have. And the other one was a prediction, seemed to fit, that because sisters are more closely related to one another due to a peculiarity in the sex determination mechanism of bees, wasps, and ants, that they should favor sisters over males when they made a new crop of queens and kings for the next generation, and that seemed to fit. But after a while, that's all we were getting. We were getting that said over and over again. And I noticed myself, too, that it was getting a little bit loose and not, there's a lot of abstraction that went into it. And I thought that there was something really wrong. So about 2006, that's, you know, 5-6 years ago, I started publishing. I published 4 papers in peer-reviewed journals. So that I got the full blast of criticism for these articles, pointing out, I mean, I subjected myself to the full I started pointing out what the weaknesses were. I started saying, look, we need something new. We can take these cases that are supposedly proofs of kin selection theory and explain them at least as well by individual level selection combined with group level selection. And the group selection had been, that is, group versus group being a driving force, which can cause altruism. It can cause in humans a moral sense. It can cause a lot of what we call the better angels of our nature, group selection. But it was rejected absolutely by the panjundrums of kin selection theory. And I was largely ignored because of this. I almost was just going to give up and continue doing other interesting things when 2 mathematicians at Harvard showed up. They are both mathematicians of the first rank. That's Martin Novak, who has his own institute of theoretical and mathematical biology, and a brilliant young woman from Romania who's superb in analytic work in mathematics, named Corina Tarnita. And they appeared and said, you know, we went at it at the mathematical foundations of the basic assumption that's called the Hamilton inequality, that is the starting point of all this theory. And we have been, it's an extremely difficult mathematical problem to work out all of the implications and take it to the foundation, you know, actually of genes. And we've been doing that, and we see what appears to be a fundamental flaw. So we agreed then to work closely together, and we did. I built I examined all of the cases I could find that had been explained by kin selection. It showed that, in fact, if we introduce group selection, they all make more sense, and they're more consistent. While they went to the bottom and found that the Hamilton inequality is at foundation unsound.
Which is something we won't discuss tonight.
No, it's a very difficult series of steps. Yes. But the point was, here was, you see, the theoretical foundation was shown to be unsound. The examples that were being used as for kin selection are better explained once we add group selection, and now we had a new ballgame. And those two parts of that article, which were very rigorously vetted by Nature magazine before they would publish it, We even had an editor from Nature come over from London and sit down and go through the entire thing with...
Oh, really?
Yes, that was unusual. Then they sent it to some really tough reviewers in math and related subjects. At any rate, that has not, neither one of those key parts of it have been challenged by any of the people protesting. They're protesting now that old kin selection still works. It's okay, it'll be all right, we can get it fixed. It can't be, it's not okay. And group selection now is taking, in my mind, the key position in driving the origin of eusociality and of altruism and of other better parts of human nature.
Well, I think, you know, as changing one's mind, controversy isn't such a terrible thing in science either. Sometimes it can get out of hand, but it's not fundamentally a bad thing.
No, I change my mind often.
Yeah?
Well, I'll tell you the difference here. Again, advice for a young scientist.
Mm-hmm.
If you were going to commit to a particular area of theory and say one class or genre of experimental work, that's unwise. You ought to have a balanced portfolio of investments, meaning you should have a number of interests, and you should be working opportunistically across that portfolio. And if one seems to be playing out, drop it. If another one has been a part of your work that you did, you built a theory or you produced a result that isn't working, I mean, or it seems to have an error, disown it or dispute it. And if you have that portfolio going, if you are genuinely interested in science as science, in the organism you're working in, you will never have trouble changing your mind.
Oh, I think that's true. And I think the genuine interest is key, really caring how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, well, I think we should probably move to humans.
All right. Now I'm going to tell you, and you know, I'm old enough now to be, how should I put it, assertive, more positive in tone than I was 10 or 20 years ago.
So you will
bear that in mind mm-hmm. when I tell you, I'm now going to tell you where the human condition came from. All right?
Can I interject?
Okay.
Though?
Shall we take a recess? Okay.
I want to start this part by reading something, not from you. You know, when Paul asked me to come and speak to you this evening, there were not many days left. I decided that I would go, you know, this building is full of ruminations on the nature of the human condition, but there was not enough time to come and consult this building, so I decided to take a little tour around my own library, which is a lot more manageable, and see if I can find things that would be apposite. And of course I did, because there are many, and the difficulty was really in choosing. So here's one of them, and this is David Hume.
Yes.
And he is talking about, I quote, the sects founded on the different sentiments with regard to the dignity of human nature, which is a point that seems to have divided philosophers and poets as well as divines from the beginning of the world to this day. Some exalt our species to the skies and represent man as a kind of human demigod who derives his origin from heaven and retains evident marks of his lineage and descent. Others insist upon the blind sides of human nature and can discover nothing except vanity in which man surpasses the other animals whom he affects so much to despise. If an author possess the talent of rhetoric and declamation, he commonly takes part with the former. If his turn lie towards irony and ridicule, he naturally throws himself into the other extreme. So this is from the first paragraph of the dignity or meanness of human nature. And I know you're going to tell me about the human condition, but I think it's a good place to start, because I'd like to ask you what you think.
Yeah.
Do you put yourself in one or other of those camps?
Say again, please.
Do you put yourself in one or other of those camps? Do you think that human nature is most characterized by its dignity or by its meanness?
By beneficence or meanness. Is that what you're
by
saying?
By dignity or meanness.
Okay, sorry, I didn't quite get that.
Yeah.
It's both. Mm-hmm. Actually, the point here is that, first let me back up as to what's going on in the human condition, how it came into being.
Mm-hmm.
Individual selection has always, you know, straight Darwinian selection, of individual competing and their offspring competing.
Within a group.
Within a group.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been, when there is a group, has always been the main mode of evolution forever. But there is such a thing as group versus group.
Mm-hmm.
And in group versus group, you have an entirely different outcome. And putting it very simply as a kind of formula, that individuals, selfish individuals within groups win within groups. Groups composed of altruistic individuals beat groups of selfish individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And that is means that group selection and group competition must have been one of the most powerful forcing elements throughout the origin of humanity. And if that is true, then we should see in human behavior the powerful tendency to form groups, that it should be a compelling instinct, and that we should have a nature in us to feel better when we are in a group we think is superior to comparable groups, and that we should celebrate a fierce loyalty to it and celebrate when it wins and despair when it loses, even as it's on the athletic field where team sports are being played. And we are, in fact, an extraordinarily groupish species. Mm-hmm. We must have a group. We must have an identity fashioned by that group. And that would be the logical outcome of a fierce group selection going on through out human history. So if I can oversimplify, but nevertheless it makes it a little easier if you can unpack it. Individual selection promotes sin, group selection promotes virtue.
So individual selection makes us selfish and individualistic,
we are both,
and we greedy. And
we are both.
Yeah.
In other words, we cannot dispose of what made us, which was group selection. And I'll track through in a moment, if you'd like, what happened.
I will ask you to.
Okay. We can't dispose of that which created us, which is group selection. And we certainly are not going to abandon the necessities that have been of our lives that are based upon individual selection.
So you call it multi-level selection. You talk about multi-level selection, notion of
the two operate together.
Right.
Group selection, sometimes it's consistent with individual level selection going on, but usually it's working group versus group, and it's promoting what we call the virtues of the group. Simultaneously with individual level selection, working it against it, which means that you would expect to find human societies conflicted always, and that's an unstable relationship between the two, that we should have both qualities and inside us celebrate both qualities, and that we'll never go to one extreme or to the other. We will, if we went to the group selected extreme, we would be like robots. Well, we would be like ants. And it would be a completely non-evolving society. If we went all the way over to individual selection, you know, individual selfish interest, and I'm not going to make a political statement here, then we would have the society dissolve. It would cease to be a society.
Well, we'd be a different species.
So we're hung in between, and that's the human condition.
Well,
yeah, and if you look at the literature and this magnificent library here, mm-hmm. particularly in the humanities, you will find that that's what it's all about. It's all about the relationships of people torn between these two poles of selection, forces working with them.
I have to say, I really like the idea that you have a description or an explanation or a working explanation of human ambiguity.
Yeah.
Duality. But I want to push a little bit on where we began, which is that these ideas in terms of group selection are coming from insects. What convinces you that this is how it works in humans, except that it makes sense after the fact? I mean, what convinces you of that?
It's always been on our mind for humans. If you will consult Darwin's Descent of Man,
mm-hmm.
he has, in fact, a very clear statement of group selection as the origin of human virtue
mm-hmm.
and the origin of human excellence. That was a section that was largely ignored, that argument, when we hit upon the seductive idea of kin selection.
Mm-hmm.
But Darwin had it right. You know, that man was irritatingly correct. It's very seldom that he got it wrong, but group selection has always been on our mind.
Are you perhaps a little less?
But it was forbidden during the 4 decades or so. It was not picked up on, it was almost forbidden from analysis, publishable analyses. Now we've changed that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're on a whole new road of inquiry, which lends itself, incidentally, to analytic work and genuine theoretical work, because it returns us then to a somewhat more complicated, but nevertheless solidly grounded model system of population genetics. You know, we're back to where we can now actually work out precise predictive equations and results and test them in field and so on.
But so is your idea that this works, group selection works to evolve social behavior in humans based on Darwin only or on something else?
No,
as well?
I was just pleased to see the man agreed, that's all. but it is true that working on ants most of my career, I was always enormously impressed by the products of group selection. Obviously group selection that diversified and drove the ants to such extremes. Bert Holdobler, my colleague, who's written a lot with me, research, laboratory research as well as book, and I published a book called A Superorganism,
mm-hmm.
Edited by Bob Weil, published by W.W. Norton, in which we at considerable length illustrated the products of group selection. There was no question there, and we were not rebutted. We weren't challenged on that. But in humans, it's always been dicey. Because there's always been a phonetic or a tabula rasa tendency to deal with virtue in humans that has to be trained. But the question before us always was, is on the human condition, is humanity innately virtuous but easily corrupted, or is humanity basically evil or, you know, sinful, and has to be corrected?
Hume's question, and others
we
before
him. We are, in fact, both, and we're hung in between,
mm-hmm.
and we might as well get used to it, because we're not going to change it without changing our most basic nature.
Perhaps I can ask you, the same question in a slightly different way. How do you think about insects vis-a-vis humans? Do you think of them as models? Are they models or are they metaphors?
Are they models or what?
Metaphors. Metaphors.
Oh, metaphors, I'm sorry. No, insects are real. They're real. They've got six legs.
No, I know they're real, but I mean...
you mean in terms of when I talk about eusociality and altruism and so on?
No, in terms of using insects to think about humans. In the kind of roundworm biology that I'm more familiar with, where you study a gene or a process in a worm that is involved in a disease in humans, you're trying to use at least. The roundworm as a model, as a direct model.
Well, right? We are using it here as a direct model. And now that you've brought it up, perhaps I should define instinct in humans.
Perhaps you should define?
Define instinct, human instinct.
Yes, why don't you?
Instincts exist in humans. They are a powerful guiding force. They are real.
Mm-hmm.
They are not the cultural universals of which there are about 150, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the product of human instinct and human nature. Human nature is the sum total of our instinctive propensities. So it's not those universals, you know, like that all cultures exhibit. That's the product of it. It's not the genes that create the pattern of behavior that in a rigid manner it does, say, for ants and termites, which are rigidly instinctive. You can predict everything they do almost precisely from the circumstance. Experience only matters a little. Rather, human nature and the instincts composing it are the propensities, the strong propensity to learn certain things and to avoid learning or to avoid altogether certain other things experienced. For example, we know just one example that's well worked out. The Westermarck effect explains the avoidance of human incest. If you have two individuals who are together in close domestic proximity during the first 30 months of life of one of them, very careful studies in Taiwan and in the Israeli kibbutzim has shown that under those circumstances, then all possible bonding, sexual bonding, is cut off almost without exception. In other words, it's learned. Similarly, the phobias are another example of a strong learning propensity. We form strong aversion quickly and even phobias against only a small set of properties in the environment.
So you mean there are not many phobias against rabbits or something like that? Mostly they're about snakes and spiders.
That's right,
and
yeah.
So on.
Also, not against automobiles or knives, but we quickly develop a phobia against spiders and against snakes, but not other kinds of creatures for the most part. And so on, down a long list of what I've called epigenetic rules. Psychologists have called it prepared learning. Or counter-prepared learning,
mm-hmm.
and we are familiar with all of these things, and these are, in fact, the human instincts, and they are almost certainly determined by natural selection. The natural selection that's at the group level that we have yet to investigate include two features, because we think of them as so normal that it's like being the fish in the sea, you know, you can't conceive that there's anything else but the sea. One of them is the groupishness that I just mentioned.
The tribal instinct.
Yeah, tribalism mm-hmm. is the word. It's just overpowering in human behavior. And the other is our intense preoccupation with each other. Now that's sort of, you might say, well, of course, we're people. Well, yeah, that's the point. But the fact that people are conscious of other people almost constantly through the day.
Probably more than animals, or definitely more than animals.
There's only one group of animals I know in which they have that intense concentration on the action of other individuals so that they are judging the other individual's intention and deciding whether to cooperate or how to respond. And those are the old world primates, the great apes, rhesus monkeys, and so on. If you put a group of rhesus monkeys in, you know, enclosure, and then you give them a whole series of stimuli, of things to see and look at, and you give them a choice, you need only one or two rhesus monkeys, and they all go and watch that for a while. So, you know, that's what the humanities is all about. It's just intense concentration on other people, reading their intentions, describing at great length the interactions that can occur in cooperation, sacrifice, empathy, betrayal, deceit, the stuff of fiction, of human relationships that we really care about. Now that's really, I think a Martian zoologist would consider that maybe a little extreme, the way we have developed it. However, that is, along with group selection, the enormous hypertrophy of intention reading that social psychologists are beginning to zero in on, that distinguishes us as a species and probably originated 3 million years ago.
Mm-hmm. And the tendency to cooperate.
Hmm?
And the tendency to cooperate. To cooperate with
each
other.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
So now why don't you let me run through the what happened that created the human condition. Very quickly.
We're okay.
What?
We're okay.
Okay. Because I think they'll go home unsatisfied if they don't hear it. Okay. we start with primate ancestors. Primates are unique in being fundamentally arboreal animals. They're fruit eaters, fundamentally. They have, as part of their armamentarium of adaptations, hands with pulpy fingers and flat nails. This allows them to manipulate fruit, seeds, and other food arboreally with extreme efficiency. When one of the large primates, you have to have as part of the pre-adaptation to produce a human. This is the human way of reaching eusociality. You have to have something that's at least 20 kilograms or more. I mean, it has to be a big animal. You know, you're going to have to develop a big brain when you reach that final eusocial threshold.
You're saying an ant could never have the brain that allows it to read intentionality.
Yeah, well, as you probably well know, insects have a million neurons or so, but they're vastly smaller. But they've packed a lot of behavior into their tiny brains by stripping away the glial cells and by getting enormous branching in the things and packing all that in. But what that does is it makes them intensely instinctive. They can't do anything except exactly that program. Well, at any rate, one of these primates in the old world, Africa, Pacific, could have happened in Asia, but it happened in Africa, comes down and becomes partly terrestrial. This is Ardipithecus, 4.4 million years ago. It's essentially an ape, but amazingly, it's already beginning to get erect on its feet.
Mm.
And it has appeared there since the split from what was to be the human line, from the chimpanzee line 6 million years ago. We're pretty sure about that figure. Ardipithecus is now walking on the ground. Chimps do it, but they knuckle walk. Ardipithecus and its descendants are able to walk and pretty fast and be nimble while using their hands at all times. That just happens to be one turn in the maze, you know, that set them up. That's a successful enough group so that the descendants of Ardipithecus, we're not sure of this because there's a big gap here, but the descendants of Ardipithecus produce a series of species called Australopithecines. And these are even further developed in the bipedal, terrestrial manner of living, but they have brains the size of chimps still. There have been as many as three Australopiths living side by side in the years following Ardipithecus and that first descent to the ground, full descent. One species, however, as they go through adaptive radiation, the different Australopithecus, some feed on tough vegetation and hard seeds almost certainly. They're the ones with the big jaws and heavy and dense, heavy teeth. Others feed on lighter vegetation, but they're primarily fruit eaters. Only secondarily, some prey. But one line, 3 million years ago, moves, we know from evidence in bone chemistry, although it's still fairly tenuous, but it looks like it happened just 3 million years ago, about then. There's a creature called Homo habilis evolves. And this species has already begun to move to a far greater dependence on meat, which means it's scavenging, possibly after ground fires when some animals are killed and even cooked for it, or it's actually hunting, beginning to hunt. And the habilines, they're called the Homo habilis now, they're moving to meat, and simultaneously the brain has begun to ascend steeply from chimp level, 400 cc, maybe for 500 cc, now it springs on up towards 700. And now it's rising steeply. And by the time of Homo erectus, we know this goes back at least 1 million years, and it almost certainly goes back farther, probably to habilines. These creatures are as carnivores forming campsites. Homo erectus, our ancestor, without nearly our brain capacity, but still obviously our immediate ancestors, are keeping campsites. They're getting stone tools made there. They're maintaining a fire there. And they are almost certainly sending out foragers hunting while others guard the campsite from other troops and so on.
So you're making the parallel.
What?
You're making the parallel between the campsite and the nest.
Yeah, you are right at the, in other words, Homo habilis was right at the threshold.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when you're not wandering around like chimps do today, breaking up into bands, rejoining, hunting for fruit, calling when they find fruit, wandering around their territory in this manner? No. And then when they meet, they're not really communicating or cooperating in any serious way. But you have to communicate if you're hunting meat, and individuals are bringing it in and they have to share it. And that's where social psychologists like Michael Tomasello has made a powerful case. The reading of intention of other individuals around you, the sizing up of individuals in detail so that you can initiate cooperative behavior, so you can compete with the other individuals within your group. In other words, social intelligence goes up high, goes up right with the increase in brain size. That's the picture.
So there's a correlation between what we can deduce from the kinds of activities these creatures engaged in, and their brain size. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
Yeah.
So the story on this is then that these groups are competing with one another, just as chimps do. Chimps have severe territorial wars,
mm-hmm.
in which gangs of young male raiders go out hunting for individuals that they come across from the neighboring group and kill them if they can catch them. It's just like human, you know, mm-hmm. Hunter-gatherer society. Well, at any rate, this had to include group selection. It's almost unavoidable, but it also involved individual selection, obviously, and that's where we are today.
But humans are very different from ants. I mean,
ants?
Yeah. We're not truly eusocial. I mean,
of course they're different from ants.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought we went through that.
No.
I mean, ants really are instinct machines.
Yes.
They're not governed by much individual level selection that functions within relationship in the society.
No, I guess
we are powerfully influenced by individual level switches.
Yes, yes. I guess I'm just pointing out that the term eusocial is applied to humans, and it's a different kind of eusociality. It's a different kind of sociality.
It's a different kind in that both the behavior program by both group selection and individual level selection are both very strong and competing. Mm.
So are there other human behaviors now, that other examples of human behavior now? You've talked about tribalism, groupishness, and
the intensity of the intense interest in other people.
Yes. Are there other examples that you think are particularly well explained by this notion of multi-level selection?
Well, actually, this is where we come to the edge of the humanities and where I'd like to see more research going on, where we can cross that borderland between the great division branches of learning. You know, the science, natural sciences, we're talking mostly biology of the kind that we've been talking about here, and then social sciences, but particularly the humanities. Mm-hmm. The social sciences are just on the way to doing what they always wanted to do, which would become one of the natural sciences, so we'd get to learn. Well, but the humanities are holding back. And I think that there's a meeting ground of where we could come together cooperatively and start thinking about the subjects that we've been talking about tonight more in terms of the creative arts and their putting forth what you might call the true natural history. That's what the humanities substantially are, the true natural history of the human species, that poses problems and phenomena that need to be examined in a more fundamental biological way. So that's, I think, where we are likely to be headed.
But what precisely do you hope to see happen?
Hmm?
What do you hope to see happen if there is more of a conversation?
Well, that's the great thing about science. I don't know.
No, but I mean,
I think it was the C.P. Snow, you know, in his famous 1959 lecture, the Reed lecture, in which he deplored the humanity scholars for holding off, you know, or completely ignoring science, and the scientists not really having any way of communicating with the humanity scholars. He said there will come a day when these two great branches of learning come together and meet. And this will create, he said, chances. Interesting, unexpected events. Chances, he called them. So I think that's what we can look forward to. That's what I want to see happen.
Can I read you something more?
Please.
It's related to this point.
Okay.
Maybe you know it. This is a different century. And I'll read a few excerpts, not all one thing, so it doesn't go too long. So in this second half of the 20th century, what should a literary artist writing in English do about nightingales?
Let me see it, because for some reason when you read...
You can't hear? Okay.
So I'm
reading here.
Yeah, okay.
In this second half of the 20th century, what should a literary artist writing in the English language do about nightingales? The first thing to be remarked is that the spraying of English hedgerows with chemical weed killers has wiped out most of their population of assorted caterpillars, with the result that caterpillar-eating nightingales, along with caterpillar-eating cuckoos, and those ex-caterpillars, the butterflies, have now become rarities in a land where they were once the most widely distributed of poetical raw materials. Now, I skip a little bit. Chemical sprays are not science's only contribution to the literary problem of the nightingale. Thanks to the bird watchers and the students of animal behavior, we now know much more about the nightingale's song than was known in the past. And then there's a whole section where he talks about the fact that the nightingale is not singing because of, you know, in expression of ecstasy or passion, but is singing to warn off other nightingales from its territory, and that there are endocrine questions and neural questions and so on. And then he comes to this bit where he says, Wait, I'll tell you. Okay. I would have thought you might know.
Well, so, I don't where
he says, to the 20th century man of letters, this new information about a tradition-hallowed piece of poetic raw material is itself a piece of potentially poetic raw material. To ignore it is an act of literary cowardice. The new facts about nightingales are a challenge from which it would be pusillanimous to shrink. So this could have been you in a slightly different configuration.
Yeah, pretty compatible, but now please tell me who it is.
This is Aldous Huxley, writing in 1963.
Aldous Huxley,
Huxley, in a book, I think it was his last book, called Literature and Science. And, you know, he goes on to talk about the humanities and the sciences a lot.
There's so many layers to that message in those words, including that it's a part of the human condition that we just don't seem to be able to stop destroying the rest of life.
That's right.
Now, that's not the scientists' fault. That's the corporations.
I won't argue with that.
But part of the, I think, our need to study the deeply the human condition, you know, the humanities have been dealing with it brilliantly for millennia, but now we're trying to put something new, add to it, is part of the goal that we should have as to why we are so almost insanely reckless in destroying the rest of life when we know what we're doing and we just don't seem to be able to stop doing it. We just put our own immediate day-to-day needs ahead of everything, even as we often show remarkable altruistic and deep-ranging feelings and beneficent behavior to other people. We can't seem to extend that to the rest of life on Earth, which we are destroying. Maybe you were trying to guide me into saying that. But I want to say it anyway, because this is one of the great problems that we need to face, and perhaps we can't solve it fully until we get a better grip on just who we are and what we're going to end up being like 50 years now or 100 years.
You're very gentle about that in this book, in The Social Conquest of Earth. I mean, you know, you hint at it with the title, Conquest.
Yeah.
And you come to it at the end, but you're quite gentle with this message in this book. And I wondered why, reading it, actually, because you've written very, very strongly about it in other contexts.
In this book, I really do want to get down to the bottom of just what the human condition, where it came from, the human condition came from. But I've written quite a number of books have try to lay out in fine detail just what damage we are doing to the rest of life, down to the numbers of species killed and wiped off the face of the earth, and how it happened and why it's continuing and so on. And it's been pretty clear to those of us in the conservation movement, and I am very much involved in it, that one thing we just haven't been able to get a very good grip on is human motivation and how to turn people's minds, get them to pay attention and understand and care about it.
Yes. So you were describing to Paul and to me earlier that you were going to Mozambique as part of a conservation...
I don't know how many years I have left, but as long as I can, I'm going now to spend much more time going to national parks around the world. I've been now to parks in the last year in the South Pacific, in Ecuador, and then spent considerable time, and will spend considerable time, in the Gorongosa Park of Mozambique,
in Mozambique. Mm-hmm.
Which I'm advising a wonderful man who's financing this, to rebuild the mostly destroyed wildlife of that park. I think we really ought to spend a lot more time focused on these parks and why, and reserves, and why we have them, what they mean to us, and just what we will get out of them in the long term of history, So in one book, Mozambique, I'm sorry, Gorongosa, I've entitled, I'm just finishing it now.
Another book?
Yes, it's Gorongosa, and it's, the subtitle says a lot. It's A Window on Eternity. And I'm making the point that we need to give a portion of the earth over to the rest of life and let it go on evolving and existing as it has for 3.5 billion years while we go and mess up the other half. We don't know what we're doing. I mean, we really do not know what on earth we are doing. And we have certain goals, short-term goals, that we all agree on, but we don't have any good sense, nor do we care very much about the long-term changes. And first and foremost among those that our descendants are going to despise us for if we keep doing it is the destruction of the rest of life, the rest, you know, a large portion of biodiversity. Half the species of animals and plants could be gone or be on the brink of extinction by the century. Of those still surviving could be gone by the end of this century. Mm-hmm. So we've really somehow got to get across the sense that this is for us and that it's really important to, no matter what we do, to the parts of the earth we inhabit, that we keep parts of the earth in the hands of the rest of life, and that could be our salvation in the long term.
Sounds like a quite pragmatic way to think about it, to keep some separate.
I'd say one half. And I'm going to argue that.
Yeah, yeah.
If possible, I want to start a movement mm-hmm. which says, which gets away completely from the idea of national parks mm-hmm. and reserves as nice little places that people can go to and see nature, mm-hmm. see wildlife, which usually means the birds and mammals, mm-hmm. and that they can find peace, you know, it's a therapeutic, to go there in nature and that's what that's for. No, that's not what that's for. Mm-hmm. The national parks and reserves are to save the rest of life, and they should be big enough so that that part of evolution, that part of the history of life can continue.
Would you say it's not continuing? Hmm? Would you say it's not continuing? I mean, obviously, if we destroy it all, it won't continue, but biological evolution is continuing, isn't it?
Yes, it's
In spite of our terrible
activity.
Yeah, it's
going on.
Yes.
Yeah, at this very slow pace.
Yes.
And it will continue if we don't completely destroy it or even badly destroy it.
Yes. So at the end of The Social Conquest of Earth, you express optimism, which I was surprised about this question.
That's my nature. You know, optimism and pessimism are one of the half dozen human personality traits that have a relatively high heritability, meaning percentage of differences among people is based upon differences in genes, and I guess I'm a genetic optimist. But then I have one favorite saying that I love very much. It was Abba Iban, the foreign minister of Israel in the 1967 wars. You know, in this one more chapter of horrific futility, he said, when all else fails, men turn to reason. And that's my hope. Okay.
We'll hope that's not just your genes talking.
Oh, okay.
But it's not just your hereditary optimism.
So I'll be going from park to park and writing books about them. That's mm-hmm. what I hope to do in mm-hmm. In the remainder. I've had my last say on group selection.
Okay. All right. Well, I think perhaps we should. Well, I wanted to ask you one more question before Gauguin.
Oh, Paul Gauguin, we didn't mention him.
We didn't mention him.
He's on the jacket. Yeah.
Yeah, he's on the jacket. But related to Huxley and to his characterization of science and the raw material that biology gives the poets, I wanted to ask you, to talk about whether science is poetic for you and whether insects are poetic for you and how they may be, if they're poetic for you.
Poetic, oh yeah, yes. Sorry. Yeah.
And how they may be poetic for you.
Oh, and it's since poetic for all scientists. They just don't say it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really important. That's another thing we should be exploring, is the creative process, not just in the creative arts, but in science. Mm-hmm. And what I like to say is that the ideal scientist thinks like a poet and works like a bookkeeper. Unfortunately, because of the nature of scientific journals, they only take bookkeeping. And therefore, you rarely hear a scientist admitting that they daydream. You know, scientists imagine, they make up scenarios, they daydream, they think out whole experiments, they think of triumphant endings when great discoveries are made that they might be able to do if they did this, if they did that. They dream of something that might be happening in nature, whether it's there or not. They think about it. Can I go find out about it? How do I test it? Einstein riding on a beam of light, for example. Einstein liked to say that imagination is more important than anything else in science. So we start out, that's how we do it. We start out imagining things that could be true or untrue or things that haven't been found or that there might be something to discover here or there. We do dirty experiments. I love doing dirty experiments. You're supposed never to say, I do dirty experiments in science. But of course, you know, you do clean, thorough, replicable experiments before you go to press. But in hunting and just on dreaming about what might be, it's just a lot of fun to do a little experiment. It's not conclusive, but it might give you a hint that there is something there to do. You know, then they turn to the auditor's phase and do the hard, hard work it often takes to bring a project to conclusion. But a good scientist is a poet.
I quite agree.
You agree? Okay, that's
great. Yes, absolutely.
Why
do you think I asked you?
Well, you're good. I thought you were going to give me one of these stern, younger generation looks like, you're losing it, sir.
I like hearing younger generation, okay. I have to say. But in this respect, I'm old-fashioned.
Yeah, that's how we have our fun.
Are you going to, in your letter to a, I think actually, in Peter Medawar's advice to a young scientist, he talks about this, but I may be wrong. But he talks about the creative aspect of science. But are you going to talk about this in your letter to a young scientist?
At length.
Okay.
Yeah, Letters to a Young Scientist.
Which is the next book
that you will write. I've nearly finished it. And I'm really letting it all out to young scientists as to how to succeed, how to choose subjects, how to persevere, what they need to know. I tell them they don't need to know much math, for example. If you want to do a difficult mathematical analysis, you don't have to learn it. You have to go find a mathematician.
And
so on, advice of this sort.
But
because I want to bring really gifted young people into science, and that includes a lot of math phobes out there that ought to be working in science.
No, I think that's true. But one does run, and you know, in my kind of biology, it's not that our biology is so different, but there's a lot of mathematicians, there are a lot of theoreticians, computer people coming in.
Yes.
And that's fabulously exciting, but there's a problem as well, and there's a problem of communication, and it gets difficult for people to speak both languages, and you need people who speak both languages, actually, to really get, you know, profound questions asked and hopefully
answered. You're quite right.
I think pure collaboration with realms that are so
different.
That's
the future of science, actually.
But you need crossover people.
Yeah, instantly, I don't believe in groupthink. I realize this is a very popular idea nowadays, that what you do if you want to get great ideas is to bring a bunch of geniuses together and let them live in, with a garden and, you know, have tea and beer together and talk. And out of this will come new ideas. That's not the way scientific creativity exists, occurs. Scientific creativity occurs in one mind. And that's what gets it started. A dream that someone has, a conception that may work out. And then that person has to get a mathematician office to, you know, to probe to the bottom. Has to get maybe a natural products chemist
or something
To analyze a substance. Because all of this technology can't be mastered, not even a small portion of it, by the most creative scientists. So they get the idea and they have the entrepreneurship to push it through. The best scientists are not the brightest. In fact, they are the most entrepreneurial and hardworking. I have an idea about the ideal IQ for a scientist while I'm at it, for the delectation of our group here. The ideal scientist is bright enough to see what needs to be done, but not so bright he gets bored doing it. And that is true.
Yeah.
I know other scientists, I won't name them, but dramatically successful scientists who scored, I'll mention one of them, Richard Feynman, IQ 125. And, okay, I'll just say it. In the schools in Alabama, I scored a towering 123, which is probably not so good. And that leads you to say, well, you know, if there are people like Feynman and lots of other successful scientists who, you know, no brighter than that, what about all these people that have 160, 170 IQs? Answer, they join the Mensa Society and work for the IRS. they're lazy. Things came too easy while they were in school. They weren't given enough wind sprints by the coach. And they don't know the meaning of hard work. They're not rewarded so much for entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. We need middle-level people, and we need people who really don't even have that much math. But they'll pick it up. It's a language. Mm-hmm. You need to be at least semi-literate. You know?
I think you need to care about the questions. Mm-hmm. I think you need to return to something I said before. You need to care about the questions.
Yes, that's it.
I mean, and you need to be, you know.
It's almost become a platitude that the question is more important than the answer. In other words, it's easy to get lots and lots of questions and sort of get lots and lots of answers. It don't mean a lot. But the quality of the research is based upon the quality of the answer, of the problem. You know, how big a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Gauguin now.
The what?
Gauguin.
Gauguin.
Yes. Where
did I pick up Gauguin?
You've bracketed your book with Gauguin.
I immediately became fascinated with him when I saw his masterpiece, Titian masterpiece, in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston.
That's
there. Or a reproduction
there.
Of it. Yes,
I see.
It's there, 12
mm-hmm.
feet long.
Mm-hmm.
That's his final great painting. Poor Gauguin. He was a latecomer among the Impressionists.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very ambitious man. He really wanted to do something new. He decided that the only way he could do it, really new, was to find expressions that gave him a sense of what the human condition is. That he was one with us on that. He thought, we can best divine from his writings and the paintings too, that he was using art in a search for an expression of human nature, the essence of it. So he goes off to Panama, I think it was, and then Guadeloupe, to get away from the noisy crowd, the pandemonium of Paris, and all of the all this highly celebrated Impressionists of the day. He couldn't really make it there, and then, unsatisfied, he ends up finally in Tahiti. He's going as far away from civilization as possible.
Is that one reason you are drawn to him?
Hmm?
Is that a reason you are drawn to him? Because he seeks the wilderness?
He wanted to find, like Thoreau, He wanted to grind everything down to the essence
mm-hmm.
in order to find out who he really was and mm-hmm. what the meaning of everything was. Thoreau did it at a little hut, conveniently located 40 minutes walk from his mother's house, so he didn't so he didn't have to worry about laundry. But that's another subject. Gauguin went to Tahiti.
He went a little farther.
To live in what he thought was primitive society, mm-hmm. primitive but self-sustaining. And so he paints these masterpieces, and finally, sick, he has a venereal disease, which he has heart trouble, and he's a sick man. He does this huge new masterpiece, which shows the whole life cycle in a Tahitian background. Then he goes up to the mountains outside Papeete, and he takes a dose of arsenic he's been accumulating to kill himself. He writes later that he went up there and he wanted to hide himself so the ants would eat him. Yes, ants. We were going to have ants eat Gauguin before they found his body. But then he changes his mind. He comes back down. Then he goes out farther to the Marquesas to get even farther away from Paris. And there he dies. But the reason for my interest in him was knowing that about him, but also that last painting, the title of which is written in the upper left-hand corner. The title of the painting is, "Where Did We Come From? What Are We? Where Are We Going?" Good for you, Paul. You nailed it. And I thought, nobody could be, you know, there's no better symbol or no better personality or personal history than those of Paul de Gauguin. And I became sort of a Gauguinist.
Mm.
I've seen most of his paintings, and mm-hmm. you know, and I sort of enjoyed knowing about mm-hmm. Paul Gauguinist, mm-hmm. Gauguin. And I think, too, now that you brought it up, we were talking about relation of humanities, the creative arts, and, mm-hmm. you know, science.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can find a lot of examples like that.
Well, you point out in the book that that you know his painting is a question and not an answer. We referred to this a little bit before. And reading the book, one gets the sense, or I got the sense, that sometimes what you're saying is, well, science can provide the answer, and sometimes what you're saying is science should be used to properly pose the question. Which one is more, how would you characterize it? Which one is more along the lines of your thinking?
I think what science can do is to actually define human nature and define how it came into existence and what its key features are in terms of the repertoire of instincts and drives and how they came into existence. And but to express the full potential of human creativity, obviously that's the humanities, of course to some extent it will include some science, but basically the creations of the human mind are our ultimate glory. But on the other hand, we need to know why we are so beastly at times and why we have this conflict. You know, we're a conflicted species. We're in terrible distress because we're so conflicted. We're genetically conflicted. That's a problem. We need to understand why. And maybe that'll help us move on through and make more sensible decisions. But the fun is going to be in scientific discovery. But then it's going to be in the creative arts and, you know, the further building of humanities.
I think you make me want to read a little bit from your book. I've read a lot of text
so far.
So unless you would like to read it.
Yeah, I'll read it. Show me.
So what I thought would make sense.
You know, there's no author could ever turn down an invitation to read his own.
I thought if we went there and then maybe.
Okay,
this
I won't
bit.
Go too long though. I don't want to run out of time.
Well, if you
I'll start
read,
and then you can poke me if.
If you read this.
Yeah. Okay.
And then this.
All right, this is from the chapter, the final chapter, called The New Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. I think that's another thing we should be thinking about seriously in this century, is reigniting the Enlightenment, the original 18th century Enlightenment. They couldn't pull it off because they didn't know enough. Well, they didn't, to do all these great things they wanted to do. Maybe we now know enough.
You did warn us you were going to be assertive.
Yeah, I did. Well, anyway, human beings are actors in a story. We are the growing point of an unfinished epic. The answer to the existential questions must lie in history. And that, of course, is the approach taken by the humanities. But conventional history by itself is truncated in both its timeline and its perception of the human organism. History makes no sense without prehistory, and prehistory makes no sense without biology. Humanity is a biological species in a biological world. In every function of our bodies and mind, and at every level, we are exquisitely well adapted to live on this particular planet. We belong in the biosphere of our birth. Although exalted in many ways, we remain an animal species of the global fauna. Our lives are restrained by the two laws of biology, that all of life's entities and processes are obedient to the laws of physics and chemistry, and that all life's entities and processes have arisen through evolution by natural selection. The more we learn about our physical existence, the more apparent it becomes that even the most complex forms of human behavior are ultimately biological. They display the specializations evolved across millions of years by our primate ancestors. The indelible stamp of evolution is clear in the idiosyncratic manner in which humanity's sensory channels narrow our unaided perception of reality. It is confirmed in the way hereditarily prepared and counter-prepared programs guide the development of mind. I better stop there.
Okay. I wanted you to...
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
I wanted him to end on something that said part saint and part sinner, but I think we'll stop there.
Thank you.
E.O. Wilson.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much for...